You forever by Tuesday, Lobsang Rampa. Read to you by Blue Friend, September 2016. Lesson 25. Have you ever been suddenly, devastatingly, shockingly deprived of a dearly loved one? Have you ever felt that the sun had retreated behind the clouds, never, never to shine for you again? The loss of one who is dear indeed is tragic, tragic for you and tragic for the one who has gone on before, if you keep on making unnecessary drags. We're going to talk about subjects which are usually regarded as sad, as gloomy in this lesson. But if we regarded things as we should perceive that death is not really a time for mourning. It is not really a time for sorrowing. Let us have a look first at what happens when we are aware that a loved one has passed on to that stage which people of earth call death. We are going along in our normal way, possibly untroubled by any care or any vexation. Then, suddenly, like a bolt out of the blue, we are informed that this dearly beloved person is no longer with us. Immediately, we feel our pulse race. We feel that the lacrimal ducts of our eyes get ready to shed moisture to relieve the tension within. We find that no longer do we see bright, rosy, cheerful colors. Instead, everything looks gloomy. Everything looks sad, as though suddenly a bright summer's day had been replaced by one of complete midwinter with leaden, overcast skies. Once again, we come to our old friends, the electrons, for when we are suddenly afflicted with sadness, with grief, the voltage generated in our brains alters. It may even change its direction of flow, so that if we were seeing the world through rose-colored spectacles before, then after the receipt of the sad news, we see the world through spectacles which make everything gloomy. Everything depressing. That is just a natural physiological function in the mundane plane. But in the astral plane, we are depressed also because of the horrible drag which our physical vehicle gives us when we try to go out to greet the one who is newly arisen into what is, after all, the greater life, the happier life. It is sad indeed to have a loved friend go off to a far distant country, but upon earth we console ourselves with the thought we can always write a letter, send a cable, or even use a telephone. So-called death, on the other hand, does not appear to leave any room for communication. Do you think that the dead are beyond reach? You could be greatly and joyously mistaken. We say to you that there are various scientists in reputable scientific centers of the world who are actually working on an instrument which will be capable of communicating with those whom we must refer to as disembodied spirits. This is not a pipe dream. It's not a fantastic thought. It's an item of news which has been bruited about for quite a number of years, And, according to the latest scientific reports, there is at last some hope that such developments may soon become public knowledge, public property. But before we can get in touch with those who have passed beyond our immediate reach, we can do much to help them. When a person dies, the physiological functions, that is, the actual working of the physical body, slows down and eventually stops. We have seen, in the preliminary stages of this course, that a human brain can live for 5 minutes only when deprived of oxygen. The human brain, then, is one of the first portions of the body to die. Obviously, when the brain is dead, death is utterly inevitable. We have a special reason for making this what appears to be a long, drawn-out affair. After the death of the brain, other organs, deprived of the commands and the guidance of the brain, subside into quiescence. That is, they become like a motor car which has been deserted by the driver. The driver has switched off the ignition and left the vehicle. The engine may give a few kicks over by its own momentum, then gradually the car will cool. As it cools, one will get little clicks and grunts and squeaks from contracting metal. The same with the human body. As one organ follows another into that stage which we call dissolution, there are various creaks and grunts and twitches of muscles. Over a period of some 3 days, the astral body completely and permanently disengages its hold of the physical body. The silver cord, which we may say roots the astral body to the physical, gradually withers in much the same way as the umbilical cord of a baby withers when cut, when the baby is separated from the mother. For 3 days, the astral body is kept in more or less close contact with the decaying physical. A person who has died has an experience something like this. The person is in bed, possibly surrounded by sorrowing relatives or friends. There comes a shuddering gasp in the throat and the final rattle of death, and then the last harsh breath is exhaled through the teeth. The heart races for a moment, slows, flutters, and stops permanently. There are various tremors of the body. Gradually the body becomes colder, but at the instant of death itself, a clairvoyant can see a shadowy form emerge from the physical and float upwards like a silvery mist, float up to lie directly above the dead body. Over a period of the 3 days, the silver cord connecting the two darkens. Eventually it turns black where it enters the body. Then one gets an impression of black dust flying off that part of the cord which is still connected to the body. At last the cord drops loose and the astral form is free to rise properly and to get its introduction to the life above the astral. First, though, it has to look down and see this dead body which it used to inhabit. Often, the astral form will accompany a hearse to the cemetery and will actually witness the funeral proceedings. There is no pain, no distress, no upset, caused by this, because the astral, in the case of a person unprepared by knowledge such as that contained within this course, is in a state of semi-shock. It follows the body in the coffin in much the same way as a kite will follow a small boy at the other end of a string, or in much the same way as a balloon follows the trailer car which holds it from escaping. Soon, though, this silver cord, silver no longer, parts, and then the astral body is free to go up and up and to prepare for its second death. This second death is completely and absolutely painless. Before the second death, a person has to go to the Hall of Memories and see all that happened in his life. You are not judged by anyone except yourself. And there is no greater judge, no sterner judge, than yourself. When you see yourself stripped of all the petty conceits, all the false values that were dear to you upon the earth, you may find that in spite of all the money you have left behind, in spite of all the positions you've held, all the appointments, you're not so great after all. Very, very frequently, the most humble, the most lowly, and the poorest in money get the most satisfactory and highest judgment. After having seen yourself in the Hall of Memories, then you go on to that portion of the other world which you think is most suitable for you. You do not go to hell. Believe us when we say that hell is upon earth. It's our training school. You will probably know that people in the East, great mystics and great teachers, never let their true name be known, because there is much power in names. And if all and sundry can call upon one in the correct vibration of one's name, then one is pulled irresistibly back to gaze upon the earth. In some parts of the East, and in some parts of the West too, God is known as He Whose Name May Not Be Spoken. That is because if everyone kept calling on God, then the leader of this world would have a most harrowing time. Many teachers adopt a name which is not their own, a name which differs markedly from the pronunciation of their true name. For names, remember, consist of vibrations, of chords and harmonics. And if one is called by what is one's own harmonic combination of vibrations, then one is greatly distracted from any work which one may be doing at the time. Sorrowing unduly for those who have passed over causes them pain, causes them to feel dragged down to the earth. They are much the same as a man who has been cast into the water and feels himself dragged down by soggy clothes and heavy boots. Let us consider again this matter of vibrations, for vibration is the essence of life upon this earth, and in fact upon any and all worlds. We all know a very simple illustration of the power of vibration. Soldiers who are marching along keeping step will break back that step and walk across a big bridge in any disordered array of paces. The bridge may be capable of withstanding the heaviest mechanized traffic. It may be capable of bearing a whole succession of armored tanks rattling across, or it may bear a whole load of railway locomotives, and it will not deviate more than its designated amount throughout that load. Yet, let a column of men marching in step across that bridge, and it will set up a momentum which causes the bridge to sway and bounce, and eventually to collapse. Another illustration we might give in the matter of vibration is that of the violinist. If he takes his violin, he can, by playing a single note for some seconds, cause vibrations to build up in a wine glass, with the result that the glass will shatter with a surprisingly loud explosion. The soldiers is one end of our illustration on vibration, and the other end, let us consider Om. If we can say the words Om Mani Padme Hum in a certain way, and keep on saying that for a few minutes, one can build up a vibration of quite fantastic strength. So, remember that names are powerful things, and those who have passed over should not be called unduly, nor should they be called in sorrow or grief. For why should our sorrow be allowed to penalize them and make them suffer? Have they not suffered enough already? We may wonder why we come to this earth and suffer death, but the answer is that dying refines one. Suffering refines one, provided that is not too much suffering. And again, we must remind you that in nearly every case, though there are certain special exceptions, no man or woman is ever called upon to bear greater suffering or sorrow than meets his or her particular need of refining at that moment. You will appreciate this when you think of a woman who can swoon with sorrow. The swoon is merely a safety valve so that she's not overburdened with sorrow, so that nothing happens to injure her. Often, a person who has suffered a great sorrow will be numb with grief. Here again, the numbness is a mercy to the one who is left, and to the one who has gone on. Numbness can cause the bereaved to be aware of the loss, and so to undergo the refining process. But in being aware of the loss, he or she is not unbearably tormented. The person who has passed over is protected by the numbness of the bereaved, because if the numbness were not present, perhaps the bereaved, with wailing and lamentations, in full possession of his or her faculties, would cause great stress, great drags on the person who has newly passed over. In the fullness of time, it may be that all of us will be able to communicate with those who have passed over in much the same way as we can now use a telephone to get in touch with those who are in some distant city of the world. By studying this course conscientiously, by having faith in yourself and in the greater powers of this life and the next life, you too should be able to get in touch with those who have passed over It is possible to do so by telepathy. It is possible to do so by clairvoyance and by so-called automatic writing. In this latter, however, one must keep clear of one's own distorted imagination. One must control one's imagination so that the message which is written out, apparently subconsciously, does not emanate from our consciousness, nor from our subconscious, but comes instead directly from the one who has passed over and who can see us, although most of us, for the moment, cannot see them. Be of good cheer, be of good faith, for believing you can accomplish miracles. Is it not written that faith can move mountains? It certainly can. End of lesson 25.